First of all, I wanted to say that I visited the Yeshiva Ketana today. I spent some time here today, and really thank you to all the teachers who are sitting here amongst us. Really, it was a very, very nice day. There was a lot of learning going on, a lot of enthusiasm. I really enjoyed it. It was really very nice to spend time there. The outline, the white paper is the outline. If you just want to refer to it, you can. The topic being our role as parents, you know, what is our goal in raising children? What is our role in being parents? And as I was preparing this, I was thinking about all the books that I've read about childbearing and child-raising and chinuch, you know, whether it was related to my teaching or my own children at home, and all the tapes that I've listened to and all the shiurim, and, you know, there's no shortage of that, Baruch Hashem, today. And one thing struck me, that from all the nice things that I've read, all the tips and all the guidance and all the advice, always somehow when you come to the end, like the last paragraph or the last chapter or the last part of the speech is always, you know, with everything, with all the tips and the good advice, you know, remember that it's all in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands, and with Siyata D'Shmaya, raise your children well, but you have to remember to daven Hashem and say Tehillim and know that it really is all in Hashem's hands. And of course that's true, and I'm not standing here to dispute that, but it just struck me that the way you always come upon it at the end, it's like, you know, here's all my good advice, and here's, you know, everything that I can give over to you. But Hashem is sort of like a last resort, you know, like when all else fails, you know, just remember that there's always people back there that you should always daven Hashem. So I wanted to start out by saying that really, we have to truly believe that tefillah is not the last resort, it's the first resort. It's not when all else fails, all the man-made inventions and all the man-made psychology and everything. You know, it comes before all the novel ideas, and it comes before all the psychology books. And we have to remember that really it is the most important tool to employ in trying to raise our children, whether they're our own personal children or our students, you know, something that applies back and forth. So that's really what I wanted to stress, that tefillah is the most important, and, you know, everybody's capable of doing that. To that end, that little yellow paper that I gave out, I really wanted to make it even smaller. You can put that into your siddurim. That's a tefillah from the Chazon Ish that he writes to insert at the end of Shema Koleinu. It's a tefillah for, you know, spiritual haslacha for our children. You can take a look at that, and you can take that with you if you don't have it. Rabbi Tversky points out in one of his books that people always speak of, quote, having children. Like, that's the verb that you attach to the children, you know. Do you have girls or boys? How many children do you have? It's like you feel that expression, you see that expression very often, the question of, you know, the statement of having children. And really, if you think about it, it's not an accurate verb to use together with children, because having implies possessing. It implies possession and acquisition. And really, truly, a child is not an acquisition, it's not a possession of ours. You know, having things implies ownership, and it's mine, and I can do with it what I want. If I have a house, I can do what I want with it. I have a car, I own a car, I can use it, I can ride in it, I can, you know, do with it what I wish. But having children really doesn't go along with that kind of idea. Children, we have to realize, are a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem is the third partner in the creation of each of our children, and therefore we have to abide by HaKadosh Baruch Hu's rules, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's guidelines, and we have to remember that a child is a gift that's entrusted to us, you know, X amount of years, and it's a treasure, something that I have to take care of, and I have to guard, and I have to polish to the best of my ability. It's something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu entrusts us with, and it's not just to do as we please, as we wish. So that's what we want to discuss. What is our goal in raising our children? You know, it is definitely a full-time, you know, 24/7 kind of job. It's a goal-oriented task. It's a constant job. What are our goals? You know, what are we aiming towards? And I would say, just to summarize, to raise a Jewish child is to raise a child with a worldview based on Torah, with behavior based on Torah, with his outlook based on Torah, character traits, mitzvos based on Torah, that really everything has to be built upon a solid Torahic foundation. And our goal is that the Torah will always be his map and his guide. And even though we're not standing there in front of our children or with our children, ultimately, you know, what we've inculcated into that foundation based on Torah, that will always serve to help him along the road of life. And even if a child does get lost along the way, he can be redirected, he could be put back onto that road, onto that path of the Torah that we established for him. But ultimately, we want the child to embark on his own personal journey of life, you know, with that as his solid foundation. And if the values really are a part of him, if they really truly are there, if we invest all of that time and effort and build everything on that rock solid foundation, then as he gets older, his behavior and his judgment calls, everything will be based on that Torah outlook that we build into the child. And when the child is faced with a challenge, you know, it's his decision and his behavior and how he's going to come out with it. If he's faced with a nisayon, his reaction to it and his way of dealing with it will hopefully be based on the Torah values that we instill within a child, whether it's, you know, an ethical challenge an ethical nisayon, a child is tempted to cheat, let's just say, or if it's a moral question, if it's a halacha question. You know, hopefully our goal is to implant within the child so much of the right Torah hashkafas and the right Torah behavior that eventually when he makes his own decisions and he goes out and has to decide for himself and fend for himself, it'll be built on that foundation that we instilled within him. Self-esteem today is a very popular buzzword, you know, it's in all the psychology books and every class that I'm going to lately, whether it's, you know, as a teacher and workshops and any books that you read today, everything is really building up the whole concept of self-esteem. And everybody speaks about it, and I think we should try to understand what it is, why is it lacking today, why is there such an emphasis on trying to build self-esteem, and what is really the correct way of building, of implanting that self-esteem in our children. First of all, self-esteem is a feeling of self-worth and a feeling of self-confidence that allows the child to grow and to change and to advance and to reach his potential. You know, again, like you're not standing every step of the way with your child, but self-esteem is a healthy self-image, a confidence that allows the child to go from point A to point B and to advance, to mature, and to grow in the right direction. Unfortunately, today, self-esteem very often is based on acquisition of worldly goods, of material things, of objects, things of monetary value. Very often, a person's self-esteem is based on what I have and not what I am. And that's very dangerous. First of all, if it's only based on what you have, as soon as you lose that thing that you have, you become very fragile. You lose your self-esteem. If a child's self-esteem is based on that she has the latest doll, or he has the latest electronic toy, or this one has, you know, the latest designer clothing, it's outward, it's external, it's extrinsic to the child. It's not related to what he himself is, it's rather what he has. And that's, first of all, it's a very shallow and empty gauge, it's a very shallow and empty measure of what the person really himself is worth. So, and it's very dangerous, like I said, because as soon as the child loses all of that, unfortunately there are adults that spend their lives that way also, that build themselves on their material goods and on their external values or talents or whatever it is, not intrinsic to them, and then as soon as you lose that, they sort of fall apart. To build self-esteem, firstly, we have to recognize each child for what he himself is, for his own unique talents. You know, I love you for what you are, and you are what you are. To recognize what makes every person unique and individual. Recognize him for his strengths and talents, and not measuring him up to somebody else. But then you have to go a step further. Then we have to lay out for the child some reasonable expectations. You know, how far do you want him to advance? How far do you want this child to grow, to get? You have to give the child appropriate standards for which to strive. And it has to be appropriate. I mean, you have to use your seichel. If it's something that's insurmountable, then it just leads to failure. There's no point in that. But you have to stress that effort counts a lot, and moving from point A to point B is what counts. We have to reward small gains, and I think of it very much as, you know, building characters like bodybuilding, you know, people who do exercise. They, you know, every day you take weights that are a little heavier than the day before. Every day you walk another quarter of a mile, an extra quarter of a mile than you did the day before. You move in small increments, and the important thing is to be moving, advancing in a positive direction. It's not so much, you know, did you walk 5 miles or did you walk 10 miles? It's did I walk 5 miles as opposed to 4.5 miles yesterday, and did I walk 1.5 miles as opposed to 3/4 of a mile yesterday, and that's what really counts over here. And that's what you have to try to get across to the child, that the small increments and the small growth, small steps are very, very important. Even small gains have to be acknowledged. But this is, I think, most important, that nothing contributes to self-esteem more than accomplishments. That when the child himself accomplishes, when the child does, forget about what you give him and what he has and all his presents and his things. When the child feels that sense of mastery, he is empowered. When anyone feels a sense of accomplishment, that's really, really the key, the bottom line to self-esteem. Giving a child a chance, an opportunity to prove himself, to show that he can do more today than he did yesterday, to allow him that, and that feeling of mastery is really what empowers him. It gives him pride, and it encourages him to go further. I mean, you all know from your own experiences, you know, the sense of joy when a child finally learns to tie his shoes. You know, we can all very easily just give them Velcro shoes and give them Velcro shoes, you know, and they never have to learn how to tie their shoes today. But you know what I mean? It's that sense of accomplishment, like, wow, I did it. You know, I just had yesterday with my son, my 8-year-old son, who decided that he has to learn, he has to type on the computer. He wanted to type in Hebrew the brachos for the menorah. It was his own idea, and I'm thinking to myself, I don't have the Hebrew sticker or the Aleph stickers on my computer keyboard, because I know by heart I typed it myself for school, and you know, I'm very busy with that, I don't need it. And I'm thinking, he wants us to type the brachos. Like, I'm going to have to end up doing this, like, letter by letter with him. And, like, I wanted to offer, like, I'll just do it for you. You know, the whole thing will take me 2 seconds. But he really wanted to do it. I said, okay. I said, how are you going to do it? He says, you'll help me out a little bit. I said, fine. So we started. I showed him a few letters. And then he sent me away. And he said, I'm just going to try. By trial and error, he did the entire thing, I don't know, maybe 6 minutes. He figured out that my daughter, who's older, couldn't even believe that he did it. He was so proud, I can't tell you. If I would have done it for him, it would be another thing, you know, in his knapsack, another thing to put away in his room, and that was it. He was so proud. He went on to Al-Hanisim, and he went on to Ma'oz Store, and he was, like, typing the whole thing down there in Hebrew. It was really a tremendous sense of accomplishment. You know yourselves, like when a child learns how to ride a bike, you know, a two-wheeler, a child learns how to swim, any of those things. You know, there are so many easy way outs, but for somebody to really work on himself, that self-discipline and that self-control that you have to very often exert gives you that feeling of self-accomplishment, and that gives someone a self-esteem that you cannot take away. You cannot take it away like when you take away a toy from a child. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, we tend to value today, you know, ease and comfort, and let's just try to make things easier, and we don't want our children to work too hard, and everything should be easy. And I see that in school very, very much. I see that as a teacher, like, you know, just comparing 10 years ago to today, you see it, how people are afraid to exert themselves, and but that creates very fragile beings. You know, the more you exert yourself a little bit, doesn't have to be the crazy amount, but you exert yourself a little bit, you create a little sense of accomplishment, and then you're strong enough to go further, to go a little bit more. And the most valuable thing that we can give our children, really, is the skill to attain on their own. You know, give them the building blocks and help them out and try to get them to move on and on further and further on their own. Delayed gratification. Also, most of the time we say, oh, it's just easier to give in, you know, but teaching a child the value of delayed gratification, of not overindulging, the value of truly earning a reward, like Chazal say, Adam Rotzeh Bikav Shalom Yitisha Kav Mitzal Chaver. You know, you want to earn, you want to have of yourself, you want to make it yourself. And to teach a child to earn something, also, it gives them a sense of accomplishment, like I did something to earn this reward. I'll give you another little silly example again. Like my son came home a few days ago, and he decided he had to have this loose leaf that somebody on my block was selling for $5. Now, he doesn't even need loose leaf, he's in third grade, he works with notebooks. Totally doesn't need that, but now this man in the block is selling it. Such a good loose leaf, mine has so many pockets. I said, what are you going to do with it? You used open book. I'm going to carry it instead of my knapsack. I'm going to fill my notebooks in it. I said, what do you need this for? No, he has to have it, he has to have it. Now listen, it costs $5. I could very easily have said, here's $5, you know, take it, go get yourself a loose leaf. I don't understand the sense in it, but fine. I could have done that. I saw he really wanted it, but I wasn't about to do that. Like, I was trying to just teach him that. Just because on a whim, you decided you see this and you want this and you have to have it. You know, kids today very often feel that they're entitled, that sense of entitlement. You know, I see this, I want it, I have to have it, and I have to have it right now. So, you know, I worked it out with him. I told him, you know, maybe if I see that you earn it and you deserve it, after, you know, a week or two, whatever it is, you know, we'll work something out. And, of course, he wants to use his own money, and that's like a whole separate story. I don't want to go over there. You know how the kids always say, I use my own money, Ma. You know, it's not the point whose money it is. I can give you the $5, you know. But just to train him that sometimes you just have to earn something. Overprotecting is not teaching children coping skills, you know, and that is really a very important skill. We want to prepare children for disappointment and prepare them, teach them to problem solve, to cope. Another thing that we encourage by just giving in this overindulgence is self-centeredness. I mean, the feeling of, I can always have what I want, it's all coming to me. You know, in plain old English, spoiled children, right? It means that they become self-centered, and we really would like to try to avoid that. I heard a great story from Rabbi Avi Shulman about a child who was nudging his mother in a store. They were shopping in a grocery store, and he wanted a banana. You know how the children can carry on. And he was fetching and screaming and carry on. He wanted a banana. So the grocery owner was a very nice gentleman, and he says, you know, what's the big deal? He says to the mother, here, take a banana, give it to your child. So he gives it over to the child, and the mother turns to the child and says, look, what do you say to this nice grocery man? And he says, peel it. You know, I don't know how old the child was. But, you know, just the point that, you know, you give and you give and you give, and that's the child's attitude, you know, take, take, take. Why do we spoil our children? Why do we give in so easily? I mean, there are a lot of different factors, a couple of different reasons. I jotted some of them down there, I think. One is we give in. Sometimes we try to buy their love. We think that by giving them what they want, you know, we're going to get their love. Sometimes we do it. I think maybe most of the time we do it to buy peace. You know, you don't want the tantrum in the store when the child wants it. So it's just much easier to give in, you know. Why should I put up a fight? I'm lying there on the couch and the kids are fighting over there, the 5-year-old and the 2-year-olds. And you just say to the 5-year-old, you know, just give it to the 2-year-old. You're too tired. You just don't want to deal with that. Sometimes you give in for your own self, for your own ego, for your own self. Sometimes it's your own pride that gets in the way. You know, you feel like it's a reflection on me if my child has A, B, or C. You know, you want to look like that perfect parent, and your child has everything. That also sometimes gets in the way. And also quite often, and this is the saddest one of all, very often people think that it's a way of relieving their own guilt if they give their children material items, things that they want. You know, it's a way of me relieving my guilt. Maybe I'm not spending too much time with my children. I'm not giving my child what he or she really needs. So instead, I dump on them and I give them the things that they want, even though really it would make much more sense to give my child quality time and listening and, you know, and working with my child and, you know, just investing the real things in my child. And since I'm too lazy or too busy or, you know, too preoccupied, I end up taking the easy way out and I end up giving this. But again, you're not training your child for the long run. You might be buying peace, you might be buying love, and you might be buying yourself a nice self-image. But in the long run, you're not helping yourself and you're certainly not helping your child. So what I wanted to move to now was the next step of trying to problem solve. You know, you have a problem, deal with how to deal with it, how to teach the child really on his own to solutionize, to help himself with his conflicts, with his challenges, and with his problems. And one tip is to resist the urge to say, let me show you or let me do it for you. You know, for example, let me type it for you, let me give it to you, let me show you. You know, a child's trying to build, let's say, a Lego, and he's getting very frustrated because he can't do it. And, you know, he's screaming and he's carrying on and he's very stressed out because of it. The simplest thing is probably just to go there, build it for him, and just give it to him. But again, you're not teaching him how to deal with his problem over here, with his particular challenge. Rather than saying, well, let me show you how, and then you're just showing him really how ineffectual he is and how incapable he is, it's preferable to say, you know, let's sit down and see if we can work this out together. Let's try to figure this out together. Sit down on the floor with the child and try to guide him so that he can figure out eventually where to put the pieces. And, you know, he cops and he understands what is a better way to do it. And like I said, doing it yourself is maybe the fastest, easiest way at the moment, but ultimately you're going to undermine the child's self-confidence. You build the child's self-confidence by teaching him and helping him to do it himself. I was reading in Miriam Adaham's book, one of her books, where she you know, gives ideas about teaching children to problem solve and to solutionize. And one of her ideas was that we as adults should periodically say out loud in front of our children, I'm so thirsty. What's the solution? You know, instead of just going and getting a drink because you're thirsty, I'm so thirsty, what's the solution? I'm going to go and take a drink. You know, say it out loud for the child to hear. I'm so angry now. I'm so upset. This is what happened. I'm going to go sit down on the couch for 10 minutes until I cool off before I react. You know, say it and demonstrate it so the child learns a little bit how to cope. And eventually, when the child himself is in that kind of situation, you know, he will have that model behavior before him. And if you see, or if your child says he's thirsty, resist the urge of saying, go take a drink. Instead, if he says he's thirsty, say to him, what's the solution? You're thirsty. And the child thinks on his own, or he's having trouble with a sibling, let's say. So you repeat for him, you show that you empathize with his problem, you understand his problem, but then ask him for some ideas, what's the solution? Instead of you yourself always throwing the solutions at him, this way you teach the child on his own to try to come up with something. You teach the child some skills, like I said, coping skills that would help him. I would just read to you a short little thing that I read in her book when she was writing about this, you know, tip on solutionizing. She said that a friend of hers called to tell her how her six-year-old child abided by this. This is what she wrote here. Quote, her friend Esther. Her six-year-old came home to tell her the following. I was taking care of Faggy, age four, outside when she knocked over her canteen and all her apple juice spilled. I told Faggy, I know you're disappointed and sad. Quote, note how she first validated her little sister's failings. But don't worry, we'll find a solution. The first solution is to dry you off. The second solution is to go home and get some more juice. Now, if Ima's sleeping, then we'll have to find a different solution because we can't wake her up. But the next solution is to ask a neighbor for some juice. This is a six-year-old talking. Now, that's pretty amazing, you know, but this only comes, you know, from demonstrating this and from modeling this kind of behavior. Often we find it, you know, tricky to strike a balance between coddling and giving in and, you know, cushioning our children, between that and on the other side, taking control and voicing our authority and taking charge of a situation. How can we best accomplish this, you know, striking that middle road, that middle balance? On the one hand, you don't want to be mush on that side. On the other hand, not to be that dominant, you know, bossy figure. So one idea is, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, is to offer choices wherever possible to a child. You know, certain things are non-negotiable, but you can negotiate a little bit around it. You know, the details, the fine points, you can sort of navigate together. You know, for example, shower time, you have to take a shower, but do you want to take a shower now or do you want to do it in 10 minutes? Homework, one of those kinds of chores, you know, where not every child is eager to sit down and do it. But homework is non-negotiable, but you give your child some leeway. Do you want to start with the math homework? Do you want to start with the Chumash homework? Do you want to do, you know, some of the homework and then, you know, play a game, read a book, take a break, and do the rest of it later? Or do you want to do, you know, whatever system works best for you? But a little bit you're empowering the child, a little bit some choice, but not completely. You know, do you want to wear this or do you want to wear that? Certain things, though, of course, really are totally non-negotiable when it comes to danger, of course. You know, a child going into the street, when it comes to danger, when it comes to halacha, when it comes to certain moral values, you know, you cannot pick the flowers on your neighbor's lawn, something like that. You know, certain times, certain areas, you can't give choices. I heard a story that really had an impact on me, even though I think it's, you know, a little bit extreme for our day and age over here, but I'll give it over to you. I heard this about the Manchester Rebbetzin, Rav Segel's wife. When she was a small child in England, she fell asleep in school one day, and I guess she slipped under the desk, and nobody noticed. It was dismissal time, and everybody went home, and she was left there in school, and it got dark, and it got late, and she was sleeping, and then she woke up, and here she was, petrified, terrified, alone in this building, all by herself. And eventually, the janitor came and turned on the lights and started cleaning up, and, you know, they found the child over there. And I guess the janitor made contact with the parents of this child. He wanted to make her feel good. He gave her a candy, and he took care of her, and he watched over until her parents came to pick her up. And she comes home, and she takes the candy out of her pocket, and she shows it to her father. And her father looks at the candy, and he goes, "A tray candy?" And he throws it into the fire, you know, and he burns the candy. Now, the reason why I say, you know, in our day and age, we would already be, you know, making deals. I'll give you an ice cream cone, give me the tray candy. Tomorrow we'll do this instead, you know. You know, today, you know, I don't know if you can get away with that exactly. It's a little bit extreme, but the point is, that child learns a lesson. You know, trafe is trafe, and that's it. It's non-negotiable, and there's nothing that we're going to discuss over here. There are no deals over here. Trafe is trafe, and it's going into the fire, and that's not for you to chanel. You know, so there are certain things that we know there are no choices, and the child eventually learns that. Secondly, if you have to be forceful, and sometimes we do, most times we do, the trick is to be firm, but not to be hostile. To be firm and to, you know, to mean what you say. But if you're hostile, it just brings out the child's anger. It just breeds a confrontation. The child just gets rebellious and becomes antagonistic. And on the other hand, also, don't give excuses. You know, when you start giving excuses, then you start leaving room for negotiation. And some kids are very good at that, you know, manipulating and negotiating and wheeling and dealing. You know, some kids really know how to navigate that. So if you have to be forceful, be firm about it. But don't get angry. And on the other hand, don't show that you're wishy-washy, because then you're really giving the child the wrong signs to read. And it's, you know, it's going to be hard for him to know where to draw the line, so you have to draw the line. Thirdly, charts and schedules. A child really works best when he knows what is expected of him. You know, lay out the expectations for children, if it's chores that they have to do, if it's their homework. Charts and schedules really help. It eliminates a lot of the hassling and haggling and back and forth. You know, it's there, it's on paper, it's in black and white. And for small children, it could be done with pictures, it doesn't have to be done with words. But this way, the expectation is there, the child knows what's there, and he can deal with it. And children really want consistency. They really want firmness. They really do want expectations. And you know yourselves, like, for example, bedtime. Bedtime is so much easier when there's, like, a routine, there's a set routine, and there's a procedure that you follow. And even though you think you're doing your child a favor by, you know, vacillating, and one night it's here, and one night it's there, and then it's very late, if you develop a routine, it really makes it easier on the child ultimately, and for sure it makes it easier on yourself. So the rules have to be firm, they have to be sensible, and also the consequences should be logical. You know, sometimes you go way out of sight, you know, the child violates or something, and then you end up punishing him to some, you know, outrageous extreme. That really does not tend to reinforce the positive behavior. It just builds, you know, more hostility. It has to be reasonable. It can't be a way out punishment that builds resentment. All in all, there are so many traits that we want to cultivate in our children. You know, whether it's being generous and sharing and patience and cooperation and being forgiving and being mevater. There are so many things. And very often, parents think that they're only teaching their children if they're actively, constantly, forcefully, and, you know, with their rules and regulations, being busy with the do's and the don'ts and, you know, giving the list of rules and the instructions all the time. And that's not the best way to do it. And that's not, it's not the only way, but it's certainly not the best way to do it. You know, to constantly be there like the headmaster and yes this and no this and don't do this and yes do that. The truth is, as we all know, the best way to teach behavior is by modeling it. And you can stand there from today till tomorrow and tell your children, share and don't be stingy and share with your toys and don't you love to share and don't you want everybody to come to your house and play with you and all of that. When you open the door to a Mashiach, if your child sees your expression on your face and your rolling of the eyes, or if you're gracious and you know how you go to the door, you know, modeling the behavior really does more than 1,000 do's and don'ts. And the child sees that you're anxious to have company and you want to share and you want to share your home and you want to open up your home to other people. So if the child will understand that this is a good behavior and this is something that I want to do. But if you don't, you just expect the child to, it's not going to be very effective. All in all, our children learn to deal with these kinds of challenges and questions and dis-no-nos the way we do. You know, how do I react when I'm driving carpool and those kids are late and I have to sit outside and wait for 5 minutes for those kids to be ready? What's my level of patience? You know, so we expect our children to be patient, but what are we displaying? When I bake a cake and it flops, like, you know, do I fly off my handle? Like, how do I react to something that I just invested so much work in? And it just flopped, it just went into the garbage. You know, anything, you know, how do I react? Do I react to simcha? Do I judge people favorably? What is my attitude in the face of disappointments? And you'd be surprised, children really soak it up, they soak it in, and they really learn from that. When I make a mistake, do I apologize, even if it's to my children? You know, you can't expect the child to apologize if the child sees that maybe you made a mistake and you were not so gracious about owning up to it. As far as, you know, getting the desired result, trying to effect change, because that's what we're trying to do, trying to get that desired behavior, trying to effect change within a child. For example, a child who is difficult in terms of doing his homework, a child who whines and fetches all the time. How do you deal with it? So, on the one hand, you could just give in. Like we said, that's really, you know, a very poor way of reacting to the problem, just giving in because I want to buy myself some peace and I just don't have a head to deal with it. On the other extreme, you can punish your child, and you can constantly be punishing your child, but again, what are you teaching your child? I mean, really what you want is, you want to work with your child towards a goal. You want to effect a change. You want to create a better situation. You want to create something better for him and for you. And so if the child is old enough, it is much more effective to sit down with the child and to explain how you feel about the problem, how you feel about the issue. What is the goal? What are we trying to achieve? For example, the child who's whining all the time. So again, you could either just give in because you just have no more patience, you can punish your child, or you sit down with the child and explain to the child, I really want to listen to what you have to say. I'm really interested. I want to hear what you have to say. But it's very hard for me to listen when you're clutching, when you're whining all the time. So you think you can say that in a nicer tone of voice. That's the beginning of the process. And explain to the child, this is what I'm going to be doing with you. I want to hear this from you. Reward the positive behavior. When you see it, when you catch it, reward it. Be specific in your feedback. You know, in other words, delineate for him exactly what you liked about the way he spoke to you at this point in time. And you can even tell him, I'm going to ignore you when you talk in such a tone of voice. And you work it through with the child together. The objective is that the child himself realizes what the goal is, where we're heading. And most importantly, you really want, the goal is the child becomes intrinsically motivated. You want the child to feel good about himself when he accomplishes. You want to give him that feeling of mastery that encourages him to go further. You want to that he should feel pride. You want to show him that you're proud of him, but he should feel the pride from within. You help him understand his mistakes. When he trips up, when he slips up, it's not that it has to be automatic punishment bad. Help him, you know, explain to him. Help him understand what his mistakes are. Help him understand, you tell him that you understand the tasks that he is struggling with, what his challenges are. In other words, you're not in this alone. I'm trying to help you. And most importantly, it's going to be an asset to your person, to you as a whole. This is going to make you into a better person. Help him understand what he's working towards. Parents really serve as mirrors to their children. You know, when a child is young, he sees his reflection. He views himself in your reaction to him. To the way he behaves, the smile on your face tells him what he's all about. You know, the grimace, the eyes, your reaction really serves to tell him how he's behaving and how he's doing. Eventually, a child builds within himself enough of a sense that he on his own can sense, is he doing right, is he doing wrong? He develops his own moral compass, and he's not as dependent on you. Initially, the child is very dependent on you, and that's what you want to train him. You want him to understand what is right, what is wrong. Eventually, on his own, he gets to understand, And he wants to learn for the sake of learning, and he wants to help for the sake of helping, and he wants to give for the sake of giving. He wants to do what is right for the sake of doing right because he himself feels better. He feels like he's a better person for it. And rather than throwing children, you know, material rewards all the time, you know, candy or prizes or things like that, the truth is that success itself is the best reward for a child. And I'm not saying that you don't. You have to, you know, at some point, you have to along the way throw the material rewards. But try that a child should not be so dependent on the material reward. I have a friend, for example, in the country, in the bungalow colony, who pays her son to go to learning groups every day. She gives him a dollar. I don't understand. Certain things a child has to do. You know, once in a while, if it's a hard day, something, buy him a treat, buy him a prize. But every day he comes up for a dollar because he went to daycare, you know, because he goes to school, you're going to pay him? Or you're going to pay him every day because he brushes his teeth, for example? I understand, you know, to get things going, you have to offer rewards. But if it becomes so totally in just that extrinsic reward, you're not helping the child himself. You want him within himself to develop that sense of accomplishment, and I did it, and pride, and that's what's going to keep him going, really, for a long time. You want to train him with that moral compass, with that sense of satisfaction in doing what is good, even if you're not there to pat him on the back eventually. We're training our children to be moving. That's really the point of this, to always be moving in a positive direction. And it's not so important where every child is positioned on the ladder of success in life. It doesn't matter what rung you find yourself on. What's more important is the child going up, or is he going down, or is he standing still? What you want is progress. What you want is positive movement. You want moving forward a little bit, like we said before, like with the exercise. It's all built on in relation to yesterday. You know, how am I today in relation to yesterday? And we work with each child individually, and that's what we want to encourage, and that's how we want them to move. It doesn't really matter, you know, how high you get. It's just more a question of moving little by little by little. I just wanted to close with something related to Hanukkah. In Parshas Bahaloscha, when it talks about lighting the menorah, the lashon there is Bahaloscha es haneros, and you know that it's an unusual lashon. And Rashi brings 2 points down over there. Rashi explains that Bahaloscha es haneros, you learn out a halacha from that you're supposed to light the candle, that you're supposed to light the candle until it takes on its own and it could continue to stay ignited. And the second halacha that's hinted at in that Bahaloscha es haneros is the fact that the menorah is lit while the Kohen is standing, Bahaloscha, in other words, he's high, he's on a platform, he's standing on a duchan, he's standing on a platform, and only then can he light the menorah. And I read in Rabbi Yisrael Miller's book, he questions, what is the relationship between these two halachos that are learned out of that one word, Bahaloscha, there must be some connection. And he says that, of course, we know the menorah references Or HaTorah, that's, you know, that's what it stands for, that's what it represents, and the message over here we have is regarding chinuch. As parents and as teachers, first of all, our goal is Bahaloscha es haneros, it's Acha Deha Shel Heves Olam Me'ileha. That our goal is not to get our children, you know, day by day by day through life, but rather to get them on their own, enthusiastic, and knowing the rights and the wrongs, and so that they can Olam Me'ileha, they can move on their own, and they can progress on their own and move forward without us constantly prodding them. Eventually, that's the goal. How do you attain that? How do you get to that level? And we learn from the fact that the Kohen stands on that platform when he lights the menorah, the fact that you have to get up high and peer down into the menorah in order to light it. The Kohen could really reach the top of the menorah to light it, but he has to stand up high on the platform in order to be able to peer down and to look inside. Does it need to be cleaned out? You know, when he's lighting it, he knows how to deal with it. And that's the responsibility of us as parents, as teachers, you know, to get up there a little bit higher than the child, than the student, peer inside his neshama, what does he need, what does each individual child need, and only then are you able to light it, to give it what it needs, to tend to it, you know, each one individually. And I just want to close with the wish that we should all have that siyata d'shmaya and be the successful partners with Hashem that we're supposed to be. Thank you.